starting off this weekend. I wanted to let you know a little bit about where you're at, because some of you have come from out of town and maybe you don't know quite where you're at. Jim, do you know where you're at? You're at the Rice Media Center. We've been here for 50 years. We were built in 1970. We opened in February. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary this year. We were built as a temporary building for film and photography by the Day Minnills. If you've seen the Minnill Collection Museum here in town, if you're here for a couple days, you have time to stop by. It's free. It's amazing. You should stop by. Really radical thinkers about art and society and culture. And they built this building because they really felt like film was the avant-garde medium to communicate to large groups of people. And you know, they really were big on social justice and how important film was to communicate issues of social justice. And they brought this filmmaker, James Blue, here to start a film program. And the whole bent of this place has always been social justice documentary made by and for the people. When this place opened, they were really pushy about using Super 8, not 16, so that community groups could get access to this equipment and use it and make all their films on Super 8. Also, sync sound for Super 8 was invented right here at the Rice Media Center because they were real pushy about making films on Super 8, that it was the people's medium, that they didn't want to use fancy 16 or 35 millimeter. And we've been here for 50 years showing movies every year, every week. We're here showing social justice work, showing documentaries, showing international films, a lot of experimental work. And you're going to see a little bumper about that. That was made by Danny Stike, who's in the back row, former projectionist from Rice Cinema. And we muscle on. We were called the temporary building when we were built in 1970. We're still here 50 years later. And the university has recently said that they're going to build a new art building on this footprint. So you're here at the end of the glorious life of the Rice Media Center. And I really appreciate your energy and the energy of this show to sort of bookend the life of this glorious place and all the change that it's made in Houston. And I'm just really thrilled that you all are here. And I just wanted to orient you a little to where you were. We've always been the outlaw iconoclast on the edge of campus. Campus has actually grown towards us quite literally right next to us very recently. But we're still here being super crazy and radical on the edge of campus, hosting all kinds of film festivals that we've nurtured over the years. The Indie Media Film Festival was here every month for 5-6 years in the early 2000s, where we showed radical documentaries and brought a lot of filmmakers to town. And the film Trading Freedom was finished here after all the collectives put their spin on the segments. The finishing project was done here. We found out from a friend's FOIA file that the FBI came here a lot to the IMC film screenings. It was one in particular which we were showing, which was you guys probably know these films, Ignite a Revolution, All My Heroes Wear Masks, and it was the ALF-ELF film screening, and we have the FBI documents about them photographing people here, and we have the documents where they showed it to an informant here in town to have her identify them, and we outed her through that process. But that was fun. Yeah, a lot of fun indie media histories in this building, so I'm going to turn it over now to Renee Phelps.
Thank you, Tish. It's an honor to be up here and be at the Rice Media Center, and thanks again to them for hosting us. You know, you're placing us where we are today. I remember 20 years ago this week when many of us here in this room were braving clouds of tear gas in Seattle at WTO. I was there as a protester in the streets with my affinity group, the Tejas Bloc. And now, you know, we're all together here again in the Petro Metro. Different kinds of clouds of gas. Welcome to the future of the plastics industry here. I'm so thrilled that we could be together, essentially for a reunion of so many incredible media activists, some of whom we're going to hear from tonight. I want to remind folks that we have two incredible days following tonight of films and talks, discussions, camaraderie, reunion, Saturday and Sunday. In the gallery, which is right around the corner, that accompanies the Encuentro. We've printed out a schedule on the wall. You can also check out the website, indie20.dangerousmedia.org. Seriously, tell your friends about it, because it would be great if other folks had an opportunity to experience this, and we don't want anyone to miss out. So I think that's it I had for now, Tish. Oh, yes. Well, we have DJ Estef that's going to join us tonight following our special guest discussion with us and following the film screening. Because, in the words of Emma Goldman,
if I can't dance, it's not my revolution.
So. Please stick around for the dance party in that wonderful environment in the gallery. We also want to say special thanks now also, and Tish is going to join me here, in our, you see Tish and myself up here now. We worked really hard to curate the show, the gallery, the events you're going to come to this weekend. Many people here in this room and beyond sent us items that we included in the ephemera, but one other person helped us curate the show and really put it together with us and inspire us, and that's Dee Dee Halleck. And so we want to give her a major round of applause. Just hours earlier, she was still installing the exhibit with me upstairs. And Tish, you have a little bit more to say.
Yeah. Also, just hours earlier, she saved the day on the first film file you're going to see. That's how Dee Dee works. Dee Dee didn't just dream up this event you're at. You are at this event because Dee Dee called me about a year and a half ago and said, we have to do this, you have to do this. So Dee Dee dreamed up this event, but not just this event. Dee Dee has dreamed up spaces for independent media, for our voices, for open and public airwaves for decades, whether it be on cable access, on satellite TV, on the internet, with the World Wide Web Consortium, in print, and her insatiable networking on connecting us to push us to finish the projects that she knows we need to finish. And we really want to honor you tonight, Dee Dee, and will you please come up here? We got you this medallion. It's a tree of life. Tree of Life is really symbolic for all the spaces that she's created for us, for the oxygen that she's created for us, for the space and shade and room, and for the deep, deep roots that go through the community and spread wide and far. None of us would be here, none of us would have had these spaces without all your hard work, Dee Dee, and thank you so much. Two really fantastic media makers with us here tonight who are gonna to present this work to you, but also we figure all of this is discussion oriented, so after the film let's have a really good discussion. But I would like to please welcome Dee Dee Halleck, who you've already met, and please welcome Jackie Suen from Big Noise Films and Midnight Films and Indie Media and so many things. Will you please come up and just say just a couple words about the film we're gonna see? Come on. Both of you, but you're both
going to
do it, right?
After,
okay.
I just wanted to say there's a bunch of typos in this, in the subtitles, because, and I know it was my version, because there are other versions with different subtitles, but I know it's mine because there's like three or four typos that, because we were. What happened was Michael Eisenminger was putting together the Freedom Media Conference in New York City with Greg Ruggiero at the Learning Alliance, which was held at Ethical Culture Society. And they were putting it all together, and they said, we need a keynote speaker. And Michael came to me and said, do you have any ideas of who could be the keynote speaker? And without, I just said, of course, Subcomandante Marcos. And he said, oh, that, of course we want him. I said, well, we could try. And so the word was sent out, and all of a sudden we got this note that they were going to be sending a video, and they sent it to me at San Diego. And I got it at like 4 in the afternoon from FedEx, from Mexico, and, or was it DHL? Anyway, and then Cheche and I sat, and it was like the day before the conference. And we had like 3 or 4 hours before FedEx closed to actually take it and translate it. My friend Cheche Martinez, who is a staunch member of Indie Media, also helped build the Indie Media San Diego. And we sat there, and he translated it, and I typed it in on Media 100. Does anybody remember?
Yeah.
Media 100, which you think Final Cut has bad character. Media 100 was the pits. It was just really hard to do titling. But we finally got it out, and we drove like crazy to the FedEx office and sent it to New York, and it was played the next night as the beginning of this conference. So that's the history of this tape.
We did a screening of This Is What Democracy Looks Like, and there were very few dry eyes in the house, because it was a beginning. It was the beginning of a moment, and I'll get back to you, Dee Dee. I want to say it as well, just for Dee Dee. Like, we all love you so much, and when we were in Seattle, coming to Seattle, we had just made Zapatista, the film. With other people in Big Noise Films, and we were on tour with Zapatista, and we were too young, we were young, and we were excited, and mostly excited by the Zapatista movement, but we also had a sense of disconnectedness inside America, right, which I think changed. It changed in Seattle because of the people in the streets. It changed because of the fear that fell down, but it also changed for us as media makers because of the because we felt disconnected and alone as radical media makers. We didn't know the history, scope, scale, and depth of all the connections that Dee Dee holds. Like, she's the most amazing networker of people and has, you know, knows everybody and knows all the films from everything. And it was, yeah, thank you, Dee Dee. You connected us to a community that we are still hopefully, you know, a part of, and that gives us life. And so the tree of life was really, really beautiful.
Thank you so much.
So you're gonna see Zapatista. I'm gonna be honest with you, I haven't seen it in a little while. And so we can talk more afterwards, and most of the people in this room know this and were inspired by the Zapatistas in the way we were, but the Zapatistas came into being at the end of history. It was all done. The neoliberal agenda had settled everything, and they were a tear in that history. And they made us remember past we had forgotten, and made futures that were not accessible to us all of a sudden become dreams in our minds. And it was that inspiration and that fueled a movement, and that movement fueled the media arm of the movement. I mean, Indie Media was not just a website. It wasn't just media makers. It was the media arm of the movement. And it has all of the genius and brilliance and tensions of that movement. And yeah, I hope. So, and also just as a caveat, this was made before HD video. Everyone has a phone in their pocket that takes higher res video than what you're gonna see. So enjoy the play of layers and the VHS.
I should have told you the order of films. So we're gonna see Dee Dee's tape, Marcos's message, we're gonna see Zapatista, and then we're gonna see La Voz de los Sin Voz by James Price about the Chiapas Radio Project, Free Radio Chiapas Project. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have a little discussion afterwards with Dee Dee and Jackie, and then we'll have a dance party in the gallery after that. So please stay tuned. Enjoy the film. And we are playing Zapatista off the DVD. And all weekend, you're going to have to be like, that was video CD, that was VHS, that was DVD. It's not super fancy. Enjoy the lo-fi analog. We love that here at Rice Media.
Back in time. That's exactly what we were watching. The eve of the WTO. When the first indie media, courtesy of Dee Dee and others, was being set up.
The other films that you made about the Zapatista.
But I mentioned at the top that if you're wondering why Tisch programmed this, so other than the fact that we were watching before, the Zapatistas were a tear in history, right? But they were also, more importantly, and you guys probably know this, everybody in this room, most people in this room, not everybody in this room, you probably don't know. The Zapatistas were famous for saying, our word is our weapon. And they rose up, you know, January 1st, 1994, a peasant army armed with more sticks than with guns, and with their word as their weapon, and a story that resonated across the world, which allowed a solidarity movement where people weren't just invited to be spectators or in solidarity, but to read themselves into it, read themselves into it, which allowed us as, you know, high school students, this is the first film we ever made, so in 1996, right after when the offensive happened, the streets of Mexico City were filled with people saying, we are all Zapatistas. And Rick and Ben and Stola were there when that happened and came back, you know, to the States with this message reverberating from them, and you know, this made us as not as filmmakers or people just wanting to use the story and the word as our weapon. And so we obtained I think the statute's run out, but anyway, we just obtained some video cameras, the first mini DV cameras that were ever made, and made this. But the reason that this became something that resonated, that we took on tour and VHS tapes out of the back of our car, and the reason that it was struck a nerve, I think, with people in Seattle, and Michael and Dee Dee were simultaneously, you know, gathering things from Subcomandante Marcos and everything, was that it was this radical invitation, and it was a radical invitation to be part of the movement. And indie media took that, you know, again, like I said, it was the media arm of this movement, and we were, you know, you weren't just consuming the media, you were being the media, and it was a collective of collectives that made this media, and there was a radical invitation, and that was, you know, some of the founders were there last week talking about it, to come into this space. A space was created to make the first indie media, and then to make subsequent global indie media things that people could just do with whatever they wanted. And it had all of the brilliance of that, and we were all more than the sum of our parts. It was amazing. And I wanted to say too, Jeff was talking, I don't know if Jeff ever got to say this last week when he was talking about indie media, but Jeff Perlstein was one of the founders of indie media in Seattle, and he was saying he was inspired by the Zapatistas. That was definitely true, and that invitation, and in terms of media, and how he could imagine that happening in the States. He said he was inspired mostly by Dee Dee's 1996 in Chicago.
The Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Counter media.
Yeah, that was. I mean, he was. I wasn't there. But he was telling. He was talking about it afterwards. He was. That was one of. So you know, it goes back and it's not disconnected from all of that. But there was this space, and it was a space that Dee has also been creating for many, many years.
Well, many people created a lot of spaces, and I was thinking about there was somebody at the meeting in New York to talk about how it started in Chicago, but it started way before that. And there have been really interesting and amazing spaces, and one of the ones that inspired me was The Masses was a magazine. I wanted to read you their statement. This was on their front page of their first issue. They started in 1911, and they ended up in with censorship by the U.S. Postal Department. And it said, "This is a magazine owned and published cooperatively by its editors. It has no dividends to pay, and nobody is trying to make any money out of it. A revolutionary and not a reform magazine. A magazine with a sense of humor and no respect for the respectable." And then it goes on. "Frank, arrogant, impertinent, searching for true causes. A magazine directed against rigidity and dogma. Whenever it is found, printing what is too naked are true for a money-making press. A magazine whose final policy is to do as it pleases and conciliate nobody, not even its readers. There's a field for this publication in America. Help us to find it." So that was on the front of this. There's a tape about it, and if you Google Red Ink, and it's on Vimeo, and it's a discussion with this woman, Rebecca Zurier, who's a professor in, she's at Michigan, University of Michigan, and she did an art show that I saw called Art of the Masses, because this was a group of people, not only writers, John Reed was in it, and Max Eastman, Crystal Eastman, there were actually a number of women in it, and there were artists. There was John Sloan, and lots of what was called the Ashken School. It was really a coming together of people who wanted to make a space for something that wasn't getting expressed. And actually, John Reed wrote the 10 Days That Shook the World for the masses, but that was right when they were being closed down, and so it never got published in the magazine, actually. But then I was thinking also about in terms of like what are some of the presidents, and there have been there was the Workers' Film and Photo League, which got together to try to make alternative media and to have voice for the voiceless, and that a lot of their material is being now finally digitized and available. So. In terms of what I've been working on, Paper Tiger and Deep Dish did together in 1991, the Gulf Crisis TV project. Actually, we started in 1990 before the U.S. Went into Iraq, but we knew that there was a war coming. And I think that was a kind of precedent for putting together a lot of video reports and trying to get them out to different activist groups, and that is an amazing, that is all up online, so you can look at some of that. But then more and more we realized there was a space, we needed a space to work. So actually before Chicago, there was the San Diego Indomedia Center, which was done for the Republican Convention. In Chicago, it was the Democratic Convention. And there's amazing group of people who put that together, including two Black Panthers, like Bobby Steele worked on that program. And Safia Bukhari, who was one of the women Black Panthers who are often forgotten. And there was Paul Krasner, who recently passed away, did an amazing moment. It's up online. It's called Breaking Conventions. And it's a really interesting show. And then Chicago was put together by Counter Media, and also Katie Kurtz was working on it, a number of Joan Seckler, a number of people who put together, and then those two programs were put on the satellite and then beamed to download links by community video around the country. So that's where the precedence for doing something like that was in 96. And so when the World Trade Organization came together, it was clear that a lot of the people who had worked on these other projects, other people we'd gotten to know, wanted to do something. So we started very early on, in like, I'd say early September, started working to try to raise money to build have a space. It's funny because if you look at the proposal, I put a page up on the proposal. I have a copy of the proposal here, one of the first proposals to get funding for the Indomedia Center. And the website is only like kind of an afterthought. Oh yeah, and there'll be a website, like basically like a calling card or whatever. We didn't really know that there would be a potential to actually transmit video. However, Chris Burnett, who was one of the people I knew from San Diego, there was a website that was called Burn. I was teaching at San Diego, and Burn was set up as a community organization, and I was the advisor, but it was really Chris Burnett and a number of other people who put it together, and it was a website. It actually started in 88, before there was internet, but it was a server that would transmit mail for radical groups, and it eventually, by word of mouth, the FARC started using it. Two different groups in Peru, the Sendero, and then the one that took over the Japanese, they were against each other, but they were both on our server. It was pretty interesting. The people in the Basques were using it, and it eventually got shut down by the U.S. State Department. The UCSD had no idea what was going on. The State Department came. Anyway, there's a long story about that. But Chris had was very interested in using the web. In those days, in the early days, it was called Mosaic. Anybody know Mosaic?
Yep.
Mosaic. And he was very excited about it. Most stuff that was on the internet in 1988 was text. And he realized he worked for Scripps Institute, and they had a scanner, and hardly anybody had scanners except scientists, and doctors would sometimes have scanners. And so he worked at Scripps, so he had access to the scanner. And so he went down and got all these art books that had political drawings on them and had posters. And he scanned those. And I think those were the first political images that were ever on the web, because the in the internet, it was the internet. And so he was very interested in transmitting imagery and video, and he was very helpful when Indie Media started. There was he happened to be in visiting it's a weird combination of people. He happened to be in Boulder when Mansoor was there, and also there happened to be a guy from New Zealand, and I'm blanking on his name, but he was one of the people who had started a site in New Zealand to transmit images. And he, they got together and they started working on some kind of program to transmit images, knowing that the World Trade Center demonstrations were happening. So there was a lot of work that was done by really knowledgeable people.
I could listen to the organizing stories all day, honestly. But I also want to just, in terms of the Zapatistas before, and then I'm sure everybody wants to talk and be part of the discussion, I hope you will be, that to me the heart of Indie Media and going into this weekend and just something to set in there is that I think that it was unprecedented. There were all these amazing collectives, and everyone that I know has heard me say this a million times, and I'm going to say it again, but that there were these, the Indie Media was a collective of collectives. There were these super strong collectives. There was Paper Tiger Television, there was Deep Dish Television, there was tons of, there was the Seattle Media Center, there was all these amazing institutions and infrastructure that allowed this to happen. But that the heart of Indie Media for me has always been a global movement, and that was framed by the Zapatistas' invitation and by their question in a way that I think was magical and maybe unprecedented, and that it was a global story and a story of global struggle, and a lot of things have changed in the last 20 years, and a lot of things have stayed the same, and if you can feel that in watching all the images, but this radical generosity that the Zapatistas put forth to invite ourselves into the struggle, to recognize that, that we all occupy these different places, but that capitalism takes our humanity, every one of us, in different ways, and that was, it was in that invitation, in that framing of this question, that allowed for movement and the Indie Media movement as well to become so global. And so as we go forward and thinking about what's happening today and now, and I think that's an interesting place to be, especially this is not specifically about what happened with that movement, but I think it's important. Rick was talking about this is what democracy looks like, crafting a narrative that would not become an insular narrative, but that could be co-opted by the alt-right, right? That was what was happening around the WTO. There was Pat Buchanan was out there, and a different kind of right wing was out there. How do we take this discontent and not allow it to be co-opted by those forces that would not allow us to see the connections within each other? So the Zapatistas for me are really about this amazing radical generosity that allowed us to all find the humanity within each other. And in this fight for life and against death that we all face in different ways around the world.
Matthew Arneson, that's the guy who was from New Zealand and had started
people who built the system that is in New Media, what was in New Media, the open publishing system. And all of these people are doing amazing things. Mansoor is right now organizing in Iraq and Lebanon, for instance. So we
should have some discussion with the audience.
Yeah, any one of you guys could be up here also talking. So
yeah.
Who wants to talk? You can take a mic. Can we take this out? Yeah.
No? Okay, I'll stay.
Maybe come up here. Or yell. Just yell.
No, I have a mic. You have to come
a little closer. We don't. Or what are people's thoughts going into this weekend? What do you want to get out of this, aside from deep, warm fuzzies and a feeling of struggle? Okay. My voice is very tiny, so I'm going to keep the mic. Feels weird to be up here.
Did you want to say something about Counter Media in Chicago?
No, just mentioning that Counter Media has been cited as an antecedent to Indie Media, as a media project that coalesced around a big event, in this case, the Democratic National Convention protests in Chicago in 1996. One remark about that was that activists there who had organized protests asked for a permit against the DMC to protest, and they got the permit 9 months after the convention ended. But the fact that using the nascent web, which at the time was just 4 years old, and using that for a decidedly potent political purpose, at a time when it was so new at the time, I think was the genius of Counter Media, and the ideas from that later gelled into what became the Independent Media Center online.
I think that's really interesting. I mean, talking to Anna about this, like, what is it? What would it do, and how can it be detached from a movement? Because, you know, like, I think to me, Indie Media was attached to a movement,
mm-hmm.
but also, you're right, it had a purpose, right?
Yeah.
And it achieved something. And in Standing Rock, they also used social media, you know, for these purposes. It's a tactic, right, to use these things. So what would it mean to exist outside of these tactics? Because oftentimes we find ourselves atomized almost, right, by the internet, and finding our solidarity turned into our opinions turned into solidarity, or our opinions on the web turned into an excuse for action. And I'm guilty of this myself, right? And there's a lot of information. So we can take this information, but I think part of the genius of what, you know, Indie Media did too was it had a purpose and it achieved the purpose, and then it also had these groups inside of it that told stories that went beyond information, that pushed people to a purpose in real life.
But maybe now people feel that they aren't voiceless because they can talk on Facebook or, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, or YouTube. I mean, is that... what's happening in this country that there hasn't been that kind of rise up? I mean, it's pathetic.
You could argue that both ways. You could actually count at Black Lives Matter, Me Too, other protest movements that use, admittedly, the corporate social media networks, but nonetheless doing pretty impressive organizing and doing good things.
For specific purposes.
Exactly. Right. But, yeah. I mean, that's the case, I think, you could say with indie media as well. The reason it gelled at all was because it was having a purpose. Defeat the WTO. Bring that ministerial down. And it achieved that goal. Mm-hmm. There was a purpose in mind, and the media served as a vehicle for doing that. I wonder if that might be how we advance this further. Find that purpose. Maybe find as big a purpose as we possibly can. And attach or build a media infrastructure around that. Just a thought.
Well, why can't we bring Trump down?
You know, it's interesting to think about the technology that, you know, is a key part of every one of these different ages of, when we're trying to get the word out about various revolutionary struggles and alternatives and steps on. I remember when, Reagan was president, I think, and there was, wars going on in Central America. A friend of mine was, I think, some aspect of the internet was kind of brand new. He was able to get communicated, download. It took like an hour to download from these rebel groups in El Salvador. And it took a lot of effort. We're trying to get it on the radio here, KCFB. And then how do we get this out? We're in a garage. And we've got this piece of paper that was downloaded from a rebel group. And so how do we get this, the mainstream media's not going to want it. We tried to get it on KCFB. At the time, Garland Ganter was the news director. And from Canada, he was reading on the air stuff from the State Department every day. Today, Ronald Reagan, asshole clown said da-da-da-da-da about El Salvador. Well, here's Garland. Here's like a communication of rebels. You want to hear the other side? And it's like, oh, no, it's not objective. We can't have that. But again, technology, where technology intersects with all this. And the open source software at the time around Seattle, and, up until now, all the space, all this kind of, satellite technology, everything, everywhere,
all the time.
And then another intersect was the low-power FM movement. Right around the time of Seattle, it was the LPFM movement. Pirate radios were springing up. Radio was still relevant. People still listen to radio. And, but cell phones, again, technology. Cell phones were brand new. And I remember when Renee Chickpea and my wife Erica went to Seattle to cover it, we were doing the pirate radio here, and it was amazing. They were calling in with reports from Seattle. We heard helicopters in the background, buzzing the protesters. And we were broadcasting on our little pirate radio in Montrose. At every step of the game, there's technology to facilitate things, and then it times out. It's not really useful anymore. New technology develops. And so, I'm just interested.
Michael Eisenminger, who was one of the people in Seattle, very important, who edited a lot of the tapes, he said that He's director now of Marin County TV in California, and he said he grew a new respect for to radio, terrestrial radio, because he said that when the fires came just last month,
yep.
or 2 months ago,
yep.
there was zero, there was zero electricity, and zero internet, zero cell phones, and the only thing that worked were wind-up radios or battery mm-hmm. radios that people had. Mm-hmm. But there was somebody back there who wants to talk.
Well,
yeah.
Hi, everyone. Wonderful conversation. I mean, I think that, you know, when we were doing indie media stuff, late 90s, early 2000s, we were like buying video cameras and giving them to people so they could film the cops abusing people and stuff like that. It was really about breaking, as someone mentioned, you know, that when the Zapatista came out, there was a crack in history. And I think that we were trying to get people tools to be able to create their own media, obviously. And so now that we have Facebook, as everyone's saying, I mean, we actually have a saturation of everyone's got a camera in their pocket. And
in this country.
When you ask this question, well, in a lot of other countries too, South America and everything, there's a lot of cell phones. And, you know, when you ask this question about, you know, how to take down Trump and, you know, what's kind of the move, what's the pivot? I think that's really important because there's so much white noise out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's so loud. There's such a preponderance of images. So many of them are doctored and fake and all these things. I think it's really about steering things back to some sort of truth. Now, when I see political movements right now that are gaining in popularity, they're not about, you know, Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders aren't like, I've got all this information that I'm really, really smart. They're like, listen, I embody some sort of truth that probably resonates with you on an emotional level. And people are like, oh, yeah, that sounds good to me. And I wonder what else it is. I mean, this music, the stuff you're showing, the music and the art, you know, the culture that's embedded in those early films, it certainly influenced a lot of us to organize the way that we organize. And a lot of that stuff, I don't see around a lot with a lot of the way when you use Facebook and stuff like that. I see it as not very cultural, very, not a lot of compassion, not a lot of forgiveness, gratitude, you know, love. And a lot of that, the way that people organize on social media, I find it.
I really agree with you a lot. I mean, there's a role for news, but it's different. There's news and information is different than the stories we tell each other, right? And the stories we tell each other are what make our movements and our communities. And one of the things that I think about a lot when we make, like the reason we make documentary films is you can read a book if you want to get information. That's the most efficient way to get information. But a film, I think, tells a story if it's well done that resonates in your heart in a different way that puts you in the, you know, puts you in a different space. And it's the stories that we tell each other from our past and our future that are going to shape what becomes of the information. The information itself doesn't mean anything without us telling a story around it, and that story includes our history and what we imagine in our futures that we imagine. And I think the technology thing was also interesting just to go back to it too, that you know, and that's going to be, those stories are going to trump any, not to use that word in any way, technological way of presenting that information that's going to come out. That the stories we tell, whether they're on the radio or whether they're in person or whatever, to me are more important than the technology. Technology is great, but we build the technology. The people who built indie media are the same people who built Twitter. I mean, the technology is not the driver of history, to quote a guy, Marx, whatever. we will make these technologies happen in the same way that, you know, Cinema Verite created Sync Sound and you know, the public radio, public broadcasting and everything like that. If we can imagine what we want and that world, then I think we can bring the great minds like Mansoor and Chris and other people to build tools and tactics that will effectively distribute those stories.
To your point about film being important, the amount of information, I would say that there's probably a lot more information that goes directly to the brain, you know, through film. I mean, like these pictures of these little girls at this protest. I mean, how can you convey that, you know, in a book? Our brains are wired up for pictures. I mean, that's how our brains work. And
I think it's one thing, I really appreciate this space and certainly the amazing that Renee and Tish have done. But I think one of the things that worries me is that this the university is saying that they're going to tear down this space. And I think it's up to the Houston community to demand and make sure that if that whatever is built in response that fulfills the same needs that this amazing, beautiful space is here. So.
Well, I'll just add a footnote. But I've already spoken. Go ahead.
Just a small question. If Houston community needs to try to pull together and support keeping the space, what can people from out of town be able to do? Because I actually visiting family from Tulsa. Is there a way that people outside of Houston can be supported?
You have to ask Tish.
You know, it's a really great question. Tish Stringer, who helped organize this and is the film program manager, probably has a better answer for you. But I do know that they have social media accounts and things like that, the way to follow it. I think that that part of the idea is this building was supposed to be temporary, and that they're going to supposedly replace it with something new. But like you just said, we have to stay on it to see what is that replacement going to look like. Promises are made, but you know it's actually delivered, and I'm sure that
maybe make a Rice Media support group to review the plans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you have to sort of say, okay, this is our center. It's made a really important. It's been a very important place in the community, and we want to make sure. You know, I think the university would have to at least respond to it in some way. You know.
That's what I was going to say. I think that the university isn't necessarily looking for our public input, so it's up to us. To
exactly. Yes. Yeah.
I was just a footnote. I'm a radio guy. Most of the stuff we do is in the developing world. It's always interesting how we, us media activist types, have been pretty quick to grab onto the technology early on and try to have it for good use. And we noticed putting small little radio stations on the air around the world, you know, they want to know basic information. How soon did the monsoons start? You know, how much are yams going for in the next village? Who won the sports, the football quarterfinal? You know, they want someone to read them the newspaper from the capital, largely, oftentimes, non-literate societies. And we were in Borneo, as remote as a place can be, and for the first time we saw people in the village, we were obviously the foreigners, obviously the radio people, who would point to their cell phone, and had a little earbud on, and give us the thumbs up. And they were listening to the community radio station, which is all 50 watts, on their cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, and we hadn't seen that before.
Mm.
And what happened was is that the little 50-watt transmitter, which is in a little community center serving a couple hundred souls, but just across the valley was the cell phone tower, the mobile tower from the national cell phone company. And surprisingly, for the Malaysian government, no friend of the person of World Freedom, put the radio station with the Kalabit people. They wanted to save the Kalabit language. That's why they put the station on there. But they put that on the national cell phone service, so you just hit 1-2 language stuff, and you can listen to the station nationwide.
Wow.
It's quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point being is that it used to be only community radio, free, instantaneous, generally unfettered, could bring this information. But clearly the cell phone, the modern cell phone, which is reaching almost everywhere in the world, and I go to the ends of the world, the cell phone's just about everywhere. And the information that we produce, the alternative views, the revolutionary views, the honesty, are making it out that way. And I just find that an odd juncture to be at. But the cell, I believe, when I tell people on radio, I just always pick up the phone and say, this is the future of radio.
Because you talked about E-Media, and you talked about what happened in the 90s, they're interested in doing radio. They're interested in doing a film about, you know, whatever, doing a YouTube, whatever they do on YouTube, and that type of stuff. About more entertainment, more not really a lot of social. So my question is, how do indie media continue in the future? And how do you get more young people involved in indie media?
Do both. Visual and audio. And captions and all kind of languages with bouncing balls.
That sounds good, but in reality it's really hard to do.
Oh yeah.
I think if there are issues that pertain to young people, they will. I mean, certainly the Black Lives Matter movement has a lot of young people involved in it, and they're using a lot of the technology, and they have changed. I mean, I think that I don't remember the statistics, but I think that Ferguson, Missouri never had a black person on their city council, and I think it's practically 100% black right now. There's a lot of black. It really changed the government of that. It's really a suburb of St. Louis, but it's really made a difference there. So Danielle, would you like to say something?
Yes,
about the role of
I would be happy to. First, Danielle Shenowitz, I did work with Prometheus Radio Project, so a couple of my thoughts are related to that. First is cell phones have the ability of having FM receiver chips in them. And so it's a small, obscure fight at the FCC level under a new administration, but it's actually really important in a disaster that your cell phone be able to receive from your low-power FM station. So after we passed the Local Community Radio Act, which was signed by Obama in January of 2010, we worked to proliferate low-power stations across the country. There are hundreds of them, and they're not necessarily in this room. They have very few resources. They're limping along. They're, you know, fighting with each other, they're figuring out how to reach out to young people. I think the aside is just don't call it radio, call it a community music studio. So I help to support their Urbana IMC in Urbana Champaign, Illinois. And we have a low power radio station, and there were some folks who came in who were like, we want to rent this corner office for $700 a month, and we're going to have a community music studio, and we're going to have to do like $10,000 worth of like enhancements. And we're like, where's your business plan? They're like, we're going to figure it out. We're going to like rent space. And I walked them over to the radio station, which we spent $10,000 soundproofing, right? And I said, here's your community music studio. They're like, that's a radio station. I was like, I don't care what you called it. It's a soundproof space where you can teach media, and half the day we have automated programming. So why don't you use it to do your stuff? And they're like, Holly, I hadn't really thought about that. And I said, by the way, it's not only a radio station, it broadcasts what's on our performance stage. So it's like you do a performance here, just flip one switch, you can actually broadcast it, and everything we broadcast is also on the web, so you like automatically have a recording of your piece. So I honestly think it's as simple as just don't call it radio. Like, just call it community music, call it like sharing space, call it happening. I don't know what the word is. Like, talk to the young people in your community. They will give you a word, and then you can use that, and it can come over. I would also like to say this is a really... maybe I'm approaching 50, and I'm like really worried about the end of the world. And when I was 5, I was also worried about the end of the world because it was called the Cold War. And we thought, and we used to sit as kindergartners with our heads over our index, saying that this is what we were supposed to do if the bombs dropped, which was the beginning of my activism, was realizing what bullshit this was. So, but I'm concerned that we are facing another series of crises
And it's really important that we think about Richmond, or what was the place in California, Didi, that with the fires?
Vernon County, yeah.
Vernon County, where we think about how can we marry the radio and the internet, because the internet makes production collaborative. And it gets us out of this shock jock, one guy, you know, spilling his beans in a radio format. Like, that's what I hate about community radio, is like the one dude who wants to talk all the time. So internet is a way that we can collaborate with one another to produce and to criticize and not let shock jock not have some criticism and have some feedback, right? But radio is free. It's open source. Last time I checked, you don't have to have a patent on it, right? You just receive it in your house. You turn a dial. It's not like really hard for senior citizens. They like flip a switch, turn a dial. And when all this shit goes down, everyone's going to be looking at the radio station like as our only option. So you know, everyone needs to make sure that low power FM and full power, but especially low power, we have backup power so that when the shit goes down, we can organize. And so RIMC is working with the city of Urbana, saying like, look, you all, we are part of your disaster preparedness solution, and you need to help us make sure that this infrastructure can stay open when we need it, whether it's a social disaster or a natural disaster, so to speak. Although these two things are merging. Anyway, I've said enough, but those are my thoughts.
If he's around, so maybe she can tell more about their radio thing tomorrow, and how that actually works on a radio level. In terms of indie media, which is not necessarily radio, I'm going to sound like a bit of a broken record, but I think it's about creating, I'm not going to be around. I think that people are going to imagine, to spend a whole bunch of this weekend, thanks to Tish and Renee, and imagining what a future indie media might look like. But as a teacher, I think creating, I want to put a prayer into the air for the creation of collectives. And I think it is less the form that is important than it is this collective, because I think the internet can bring us together. It can also tear us apart. I have a lot of friends who will not even open half of, you know, the videos, the really traumatic videos around the Black Lives Matter anymore, because for them it is decontextualized. It is without and is inundating them with violence, right? But I feel like if they were part of a collective, if there was a way that they were working with people put that out, especially if you can actually physically do that, that is the most empowering, that was the most transformative and amazing part of indie media, I think, was the physical gatherings of people and the collaboration, almost like egoless in many ways, or the most egoless workplace that I've ever been in. That is, I think, transformative, whether you're making radio or whether you're making a film, that is something I hope that everybody in their life gets to feel. And I think, I don't know, maybe I've worked with kids and done that.
Don't forget media podcasts. Mm-hmm. So you can actually put old radio shows on the internet, and you can actually listen to them. If you have like an unpredictable schedule, you can just play them on the bus. And so you don't have to wait for a specific time to listen to a radio show that you really wanted to.
I think it'll be kind of stream consciousness, but it seems to me that it's really important for us. I mean, I really appreciate what you said about collective power in physical spaces, and not dependent on corporate institutions or academic institutions. In indie media, if we look at that we are, at the end of capitalism, and we look back at what indie media represents, what can we learn from that? How can we see that model and expand that on a hyper-local place where we are creating spaces for people, physical spaces for people to come together collectively and be critical and independent thinkers. To me, that is the inspiration. 20 years ago, and much longer than that, you know, when we project ourselves into the future.
Yeah, we were disobeying the rules that would have us atomized and fighting for our own survival individually.
That's
and
right.
We're doing something bigger. And I agree. Like, I find, like,
you know, it can be the takeover of faith. I mean, I haven't fully sorted this out. I think I slammed on it with, like, my thoughts mm-hmm. about it. But I think we all have these thoughts, right, that they're... Our personal lives are being commodified. Our very personal lives are being commodified. Every aspect of our lives are being commodified. And that was a line from the Fourth World War, actually. But it's true today. It's true even more today that right now the internet is being used to atomize us, to surveil us, to sell us things and whatever. And how do we disobey that as a collective, how do we do that with each other?
Yeah, I mean, this is what I've been thinking about all week and for the past many years, actually, because back in the day, during the media days, you know, we were all, like, if we all can just get on the internet, we will all connect, and we did, but we had those physical spaces to deal with because we actually have to produce something. And now, going back to what you were saying, what Neil Pearson calls the medium is the method, like, if you sit around a radio, you're sitting around, when it first came out, you're sitting around your family and your neighbors, and it's a communal experience. Whereas now, this cell phone thing, and you can produce a movie on this thing, and never, ever have to interact with anyone else to do so, that poses a challenge to how do we get people face-to-face, working together in collectives, in physical spaces, to do what? They can do all of it at home. So that's, I think, the challenge, is like, what can we now get people off the internet to do in person? Is it media?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started a space in Bushwick and it was art. People actually do want a reason to come together. And it might not be to make a film that goes viral or whatever. Maybe it's just to make art.
Maybe it's to have dinner.
You know, like, maybe we need to go analog now.
There's a group called Woodbine in Queens, and they're organizing by having these Sunday potlucks, and it's been, like, incredibly successful, amazing, interesting kind of things that have developed from that. They have weekly talks during the week of the different people come in, and they have a bookstore, which they originally thought they'd have to, like, support. They actually budgeted for it, that they would have to pay money into it. It's actually making more money and supporting their group now. But it's an interesting phenomenon that they've got, I think, upwards. They have 60 people that come every. They're going to have to get a bigger space for this potlucks, and they have over 200 people in their community, their CSA. They started with like 8 people in the CSA, and now it's grown. So there is a need people have to come together physically and to eat together and to really try to figure things out. So I'm really glad you all are here. It's I think it's an important meeting. Somebody back there with it.
I used to be part of a video collective for social media, and a few years ago we had a self-reflection that we produced like hundreds of videos every year, and we were basically just feeding people videos on the internet, on the phone, and really feeding them into this whole thing that we were trying to sort of get people to break out of. And so we started a documentary series that was meant specifically to be screened in spaces like this or community spaces and whatnot. And it had a fair bit of success. Like, I think I left the collective back in May, but they're going to release their 23rd episode since it started 2 years ago. And at least when I look at the things that sort of radicalized me, that turned me into the filmmaker that I am today, it was watching any media and documentaries on the saying that maybe I just feel nostalgic for that time, but I do think that we need to create physical spaces where people actually meet each other and see each other and face to face. But the other thing too is that, and I know that it's going to be repetitive, but I think skill sharing is something that's been really lost, and a lot of things that I learned, not just media making, but also the politics that I learned through meeting advocates and media was because people were willing to teach me these things, not just video editing, but also teaching me about anarchism and whatnot. And I did submedia by myself for many years, and I realized at one point that I could not do it by myself all this time, and so I started bringing people in, and we started teaching each other and learning from each other, and now the collective actually can run by itself, and I can go in on do other things. But I think that the skill sharing that we have to be a little more proactive. I think that we actually have to seek out people that we see that have that show promise and teaching the skills and do follow-ups and just say, like, here's a workshop I'm doing for Premiere. Good luck, you know, kind of check in like a year later and see how they're doing and see if we
can actually. That was a huge part of indie media, right? It was really heartwarming, and we were all really little, and so it was like they were touring the indie, they played it on Democracy Now, touring the IMC, and they were like, you know, people coming here with nothing, and then, you know, there's people over there teaching you how to lay out a newspaper, and there's people over there who will teach you how to do a, it was exciting, nice to be there and learning new things, and yeah, so it's so important.
And hats off to Sub-Media. Yeah. The stimulator.
Yeah.
Woo!
You were
here
too.
Of course.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Selfie.
I'm gonna invite everyone to go back into the gallery space. There's a DJ of staff back there. There's beer back there. We can continue chatting.
Round of applause for Tim.